Hello, listeners. This is Carolyn Yeager, bringing you the 11th installment of my reading of the Wehrmacht War Crimes Bureau, 1939 to 1945, a book written by Alfred de Zayas from the surviving files of this bureau. The original publication of this book in German was in 1979. 10 years later, in 1989, the English translation that I am using was released. There have been no updates in this version since that time. I will be reading chapter 20 in this installment, titled Lvov. That's spelled L-V-O-V. The situation found in the prisons of Lvov, Ukraine, when the Wehrmacht first entered the city on June 30, 1941, was shocking, to say the least. The prisons were filled with thousands of brutally murdered Ukrainians and also Poles. There is no doubt that this was the work of the political arm of the Soviet Red Army. But once again, our author tries to balance out the murdering with feeble suggestions that the SD and SS murdered 7,000 Jews there, when it was the Ukrainian people in the various cities and towns who carried out mass reprisal killings of the Jews, because the Ukrainians saw them as responsible for helping the Soviets arrest, torture, and kill their family members. You can be sure that everything de Zayas reports in this book is fully documented, and it is bad enough. But the situation was very much worse than what he was willing to say in this book, and for the reasons of political power that I have already given. Even on the Wikipedia page for NKVD prisoner massacres, it says that estimates of the death toll vary between locations. Nearly 9,000 in the Ukrainian SSR, or Soviet Socialist Republic, 20 to 30,000 in eastern Poland, now part of western Ukraine, with the total number reaching approximately 100,000 victims of extrajudicial executions in the span of a few short weeks. And I have some reliable reports from other sources. From Volodymyr Kubiovic, editor of the book Ukraine, a Concise Encyclopedia, put out by the University of Toronto Press, he wrote, quote, "The Bolsheviks succeeded in annihilating some 10,000 political prisoners in western Ukraine before and after the outbreak of hostilities," and says that massacres took place in the prisons in Lviv, meaning also Lvov, Zolochiv, Rivne, Dubno, Lusk, etc. And this somewhat compares to what de Zayas leaves us with the impression that there was maybe 3,000 to 4,000, even if that many, just in the area of western Ukraine. But the general number given is 10,000. In the book called Encyclopedia of Ukraine, which might be the same as the one I just gave you, it says, quote, "Before fleeing the German advance, the Soviet occupational regime murdered thousands of Ukrainian civilians, mainly members of the city of Lvov's intelligentsia." And then Orest Subtelny, who wrote Ukraine, a History, also published by the University of Toronto Press in 1994, I quote, "The Soviets' hurried retreat had tragic consequences for thousands of political prisoners in the jails of western Ukraine. Unable to evacuate them in time, the NKVD slaughtered their prisoners en masse during the week of 22nd to 29th June 1941, regardless of whether they were incarcerated for major or minor offenses. Major massacres occurred in Lviv, Sambir, which Desaias called Sambor, and Stanislaviv in Galicia, where about 10,000 prisoners died, and in Rivne and Lutsk in Volhynia, where another 5,000 perished. Coming on the heels of the mass deportations and growing Soviet terror, these executions added greatly to the West Ukrainians' abhorrence of the Soviets. And another quote, a short one from Hans Frank, who wrote a book before he was executed by the Nuremberg Tribunal. Hans Frank was Governor General of occupied Poland, and he wrote, quote, right after the entry, meaning the entry of German forces, we were shown 2,400 dead bodies of Ukrainians liquidated with a shot at the scruff of the neck at the city jail of Lemberg, which is the German name for Lvov, by the Soviets prior to their marching off, unquote. And I also want to give you something about the domination of the NKVD by Jews. Here is just one report. It reads, who was responsible for the 1941 pre-German slaughter of Ukrainians? The NKVD, obviously, and it is frequently stated in the passages above that the NKVD was dominated by Jews. But was this claim or this perception of disproportionate Jewish participation in the Soviet secret police accurate? Observations such as the following suggest that perhaps it was. And then it gives this paragraph. Yoram Sheftel, S-H-E-F-T-E-L, John Demanyuk's Israeli defense attorney, reports the following in connection with his visit to Simferopol, Ukraine, KGB headquarters, in 1990. On the right-hand wall was a stone memorial plaque engraved with the names of about 30 KGB men from Simferopol who had fallen in the Great Patriotic War, as the Soviets call World War II. I was shocked and angry as I read the names. The first was Polonsky and the last Levenstein, and all those between were ones like Zalmanowitz, Geller, and Kagan, all Jews. And he goes on to explain it this way, because this Sheftel is a Zionist who was living in Israel. He said, the best of Jewish youth in Russia, the cradle of Zionism, had sold itself and its soul to the Red Devil. Well, naturally, he sees the Jews as good people. He sees the Zionism as a positive and good thing. He is a Zionist himself, so he is trying to tell us that these good Jewish youth had been corrupted by the Red Devil. Not much of an explanation there, is it? And while there's a great deal more that can be quoted, I'm going to stop here. And after giving that background, showing that it was worse than our author wishes, or perhaps felt he was allowed to say, I will proceed with the reading of chapter 20. This is quite another gruesome chapter, and really heartrending. He starts out placating the powers that be in the very first paragraph. Every scholarly analysis of the events that occurred in Lvov in the summer of 1941 is fraught with non-scholarly dangers, the dangers of emotional reactions, polemical disputes, quotations out of context, deliberate distortion and misuse for political purposes. Indeed, because this complex of murders has remained a politically sensitive issue for over four decades, it is prudent at the outset to distinguish three murder phases. 1. The measures taken by the NKVD against Ukrainian and Polish political prisoners in June of 1941. 2. The pogroms carried out by Ukrainian and Polish civilians against local Jews. And 3. The murders of 38 Polish professors and at least 7,000 Jews by the SD and SS. In keeping with its limited authority, the War Crimes Bureau focused only on the crimes committed by the NKVD. Its files show that Bureau members knew about the local pogroms against the Jews, though no specific investigations of these were conducted, but provide no indication that they were aware of the SD and SS murders. Well, maybe because they didn't happen. Continuing. This chapter is limited in scope by the available Bureau records and therefore concentrates on the first of the three murder phases. In the early hours of 30th June 1941, the Polish-Ukrainian city of Lvov was occupied by the 1st Mountain Division of the German 49th Army Corps. There was little resistance since Soviet troops had already abandoned the area. The intelligence section of the 49th Army Corps observed in its first report, dated that same day, quote, according to the account of Major Heinz, commander of a battalion of Regiment 800, thousands of brutally murdered persons were found in the Lvov prisons. The 1st and 4th Mountain Division are hereby ordered to assign journalists and photographers to cover these atrocities. The chief military judge of the corps and the liaison officer of the Foreign Office with the high command of the 17th Army have been sent to Lvov to carry out in-depth investigations. The German investigations, then, did not originate with the Bureau. The number of victims was so great that three army judges immediately commenced inquiries on their own without awaiting specific instructions from Berlin. They are Judge Hans Tomforda with the 603rd Garrison Headquarters, Judge Erich Wilke of the 49th Army Corps, and Judge Wilhelm Müller with the High Command of the 17th Army. The next section is headed The Testimony of German Witnesses. Barely a few hours after the German troops occupied Lvov, the 603rd Garrison Headquarters moved in and began to investigate the extraordinary events that had preceded the German arrival. Upon learning of the mass killings, Judge Tomforda asked his medical officer, Dr. Georg Seltzer, to accompany him to the former OGPU prison, to the Brigidki prison, to the former military prison known as Samarstanov. He interrogated a number of witnesses and prepared a preliminary report the same day. Wilke, chief judge of the 49th Army Corps, issued a report dated 1st July 1941. It said, quote, the examination of the bodies found at the OGPU prison indicated that the killings had been preceded by torture. The majority of the victims are Ukrainians. The rest are Polish. Witnesses also reported that in this prison, two German wounded pilots had been interned. A Luftwaffe belt and a pilot's cap were found in the prison. In one of the mass graves, a Luftwaffe helmet was found. Thus, it must be assumed that these German airmen are among the bodies that could not be identified, unquote. Judge Wilke remained in Lvov until 6 July and took the sworn depositions of numerous witnesses, including those of senior medical officer Dr. Richard Eckel, veterinarian Dr. Joseph Brachetka, and non-commissioned officer Kurt Dietrich. Further witness depositions, including those of Polish and Ukrainian detainees who had survived the liquidations at the prisons, were obtained by Judge Müller on special assignment to the High Command of the 17th Army. On 6 July 1941, Müller took the deposition of Dr. Seltzer, who had accompanied Tomforda to the prisons on 30th June 1941. It said, quote, the Brigidki prison was still burning. There I met a young Ukrainian aged about 24 years. He claimed that 24 hours before, shortly before he was to be executed, he had succeeded in escaping from cell 3 of the left wing. He guided me through the cellars, the ground floor, and the first floor of the prison. The people who rushed in through the main entrance wailed and lamented while asking to see their relatives, with whom they had been in contact 2 days before by shouting from outside the prison. We discovered in the first four cellars a considerable number of bodies, the upper layer being relatively fresh and the lower layers in the pile already in advanced decomposition. In the fourth cellar, the bodies were covered by a thin layer of sand. In the first courtyard, we found several stretchers stained with blood. On one of the stretchers, I saw the body of a male who had been killed by a bullet through the back of the head. I ordered that the cellar should be immediately cleared, and in the course of the next 3 days, 423 corpses were brought out to the courtyard for identification. Among the bodies, there were young boys aged 10, 12, and 14, and young women aged 18, 20, and 22, besides old men and women. From there, I continued to the former OGPU prison. We broke the door leading to the lower prison rooms and saw there four corpses at the foot of the stairway, among them a young woman aged about 20 years, who apparently was shot at the very last minute. In the first large room, the corpses were piled up to about half the height of the room. In the courtyard were two mounds of earth from which corpses stuck out. There, too, the recovery of the corpses was immediately begun, and they were carried to the main courtyard. In the second courtyard of the OGPU prison, I found at one of the gates a Luftwaffe cap and a parachute belt. At the military prison in the northern part of the town, the stench of decomposition was so strong and there was so much blood under the mountains of corpses that we had to wear a Polish gas mask in order to enter the cellar and carry out the necessary investigations. Young women, men, and older women were piled up layer upon layer all the way to the ceiling. The third and fourth cellars were only about 3/4 full. Over 460 corpses were taken out of these cellars. Many of the bodies showed evidence of serious torture, mutilations of arms and legs, and shackling. The recovery of the remaining bodies was stopped upon orders of the commander because as a consequence of the heat, the decomposition of the bodies was already advanced and there was no possibility of identifying the scantily dressed corpses. Unquote. At the military hospital, the bodies of three members of the Luftwaffe were found. Judge Mueller ordered a medico-legal autopsy to determine the cause of death, and the pathologist of the 17th Army, Dr. Herbert Siegmund, was entrusted with the task. The corpses of four other German airmen found at the OGPU prison were also subjected to forensic investigation. On 3rd July 1941, Judge Mueller took the deposition from Dr. Siegmund, who explained that the first three soldiers had been shot dead in their hospital beds. Quote, "The body lying on the left bed next to the window had a superficial skin wound on the right chest, the size of the palm of my hand. The wound was several days old and had been freshly dressed. Moreover, there was a more recent bullet wound inflicted by a 6.5 millimeter bullet through the skull slightly over the left ear. The exit wound was about 1 centimeter in diameter through the right temple, which was considerably destroyed. The body in the middle bed had a broken jaw that had been professionally bandaged. The examination also established a fresh bullet wound on the left chest, 4 centimeters down from the nipple, in the area of the heart. The body on the third bed next to the wall had a large wound in the underside of the lower leg. A fresh bullet wound of the same caliber as that seen in the other corpses had been inflicted on the right side of the victim's stomach, some 6 centimeters under the costal arch." Unquote. Examination of the four other flyers' bodies indicated that they had not been previously wounded. Three had been killed by a shot through the head. The fourth had no head injuries, but the rest of the body was in such an advanced state of decomposition that an autopsy was not deemed feasible. The officer responsible for removing thousands of corpses from the prisons and arranging for their proper burial was Lieutenant Walter Lemmer. In his deposition before Judge Mueller, dated 7 July 1941, he stated, "On the evening of 1st July 1941, I went to the Brigidki prison and observed that already a substantial number of corpses had been taken out of the cells and brought out into the courtyard. I estimated the number of corpses at about 200. On the same night, I arranged for the burial of 50 more bodies. They were carried to the Ukrainian cemetery and interred in a mass grave. In the course of the next day, some 300 bodies were buried. But there were still countless bodies in the cellar. They had been piled up layer upon layer all the way to the ceiling. The floor of the cellar was flooded with blood. It was not possible to carry out an orderly removal because of the advanced decomposition of the corpses. It was not possible to enter the cellar without an oxygen apparatus. Upon orders of the city commander, lime chloride was poured over the bodies and the openings of the cellars were bricked up. I estimate the number of bodies still remaining in the cellar at about 1,000. It is possible that there were further cellars into which we were not able to go. Late in the afternoon of 2 July 1941, I began the task of clearing up the NKVD prison. I estimate that there were some 150 corpses in the courtyard. There were also corpses in the cellars, which had been covered with sand. I cannot estimate how many. The entrances were bricked up by order of the city commander of Lvov. The bodies in the courtyard were taken to the Ukrainian cemetery for burial. I had nothing to do with the clearing up of the Semarstanov prison, but I heard that the cellars were similarly full of corpses. On Friday, 4th July 1941, I went to the prison of the local courthouse. According to the prison administrator, there was a mass grave in the courtyard. I myself saw the grave mound of about 4 by 6 meters. The administrator further informed me that a large number of corpses remained in the cellars. As incredible as it is, we don't hear much about the atrocities of the Soviets to what they considered their own people, the Ukrainians. No, we only hear about German atrocities, most of which never occurred. But the thousands murdered in Lvov and in many other places in the Ukraine, as it was called at that time, definitely did take place. The next section is headed The Testimony of Ukrainian and Polish Witnesses. Besides recording the confirming testimonies of many more German officers and medical doctors, the German judges also took the depositions of numerous Ukrainian and Polish witnesses. On 4th July 1941, Joseph Pilchiewicz, an employee of the surgery division in the Lvov hospital, testified before Judge Mueller that on 22nd June, two wounded German soldiers had been brought to the hospital. On 29th June, both were shot by the Soviet commissars Loganov and Maslov. The responsible chief of section, Dr. Czeslaw Sandlinski, stated on 4th July 1941 that he had treated three wounded German soldiers for broken bones. Subsequently, he learned that all three had been killed by commissars. The nurse, Sofia Griglovna, remembered that she had brought tea to these soldiers and that the two commissars chased her out of the room and told her that the wounded Germans would be shot. All three witnesses gave their testimony under oath. On July 5, 1941, Judge Mueller interrogated a survivor of the massacre, the Ukrainian teacher Leo Fedoruk, who spoke with the aid of an interpreter. Quote, "On 17th March 1941, I was arrested at the school by members of the NKVD. The shootings at the prison began 2 days after the outbreak of war. The following night we were taken into the interrogation room around 1 or 2 in the morning. Three persons sat at a table with a red cloth on it. One of them was a first lieutenant. The other person in civilian dress was the prison prosecutor. I could not recognize the third person because the room was lighted only by candles. There was a list on the table, and each prisoner was supposed to give his name. The three persons then decided who should be shot. Since my name was not properly written on the list, I was taken away to a solitary cell. Only 12 persons survived, 8 men and 4 women. Unquote. Notice that this man was an ordinary school teacher, and he was arrested right away by the NKVD for the simple reason that he was a teacher, that he was considered one of the intelligentsia or the intellectual class. Those are the persons that they always wanted to get rid of, and they got rid of him first. Another Ukrainian survivor, Omelian Matla, testified before Judge Mueller on 6 July 1941. Quote, on 7th August 1940, I was arrested in my home by members of the NKVD on account of my links with the OUN, which is the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists. On the second day after the outbreak of the war, I noticed a lot of movement in the prison. Around 5 or 6 in the morning, the door of my cell was opened and 7 NKVD men came in with the prison director. Someone shouted, "Lie down, you whores!" And at that very moment, the shooting began. 12 of us were immediately killed. 2 were seriously wounded. 3 were not hit. I survived the massacre because one of the victims fell on top of me. The NKVD men then rushed from cell to cell and shot down the detainees. After the last shots had been fired, I stood up. Suddenly, I heard them coming back. I crept under a corpse and smeared blood on my face. The men again entered our cell and fired 3 more times. They continued from cell to cell, and then I heard, "Come quickly to the courtyard. The cars are ready to go." I remained a while longer in my cell waiting to see whether the NKVD men would come again. Unquote. On 8 July 1941, Judge Mueller took the deposition of Ukrainian teacher Bohdan Kazinyuski, who had been arrested by the NKVD because of his membership in the OUN. With the help of an interpreter, Kazinyuski described his experiences at Brigidki prison. Quote, on Tuesday, 24 June 1941, that's only 2 days after the start, the NKVD men temporarily left the prison. We broke out of our cells and attempted to escape. The courtyard was blocked, however, and we were unable to get out. While we were standing in the courtyard, machine guns started firing at us. Numerous persons were wounded and others killed. We therefore retreated into the prison. The NKVD men returned and forced some 90 of us into a large cell. During the following day, persons were called out, and we heard then the shooting and the cries. Of the 90, only 22 survived. My name had, in fact, been called out, but I did not answer. On 28 June, we heard many shots. After a while, we discovered that civilians had entered the prison to free us. The NKVD men had already abandoned the prison. I estimate that the number of detainees at Brigidki prison was around 10,000, of whom only 600 to 800 came out alive. Unquote. On 7 July 1941, Josefa Sosiada, a Polish widow, testified before Judge Mueller. Quote, on Monday, 30th June 1941, I went to the NKVD prison because I had heard that German troops were already in town. I first went to the courtyard, where I at once saw numerous corpses, including those of 3 men whose color had turned dark, and of a woman who was totally naked. Through a window, I saw many corpses butchered on a table. Through another window, I saw the body of a girl hanging from a lamp. She was about 8 years old. The corpse was naked and had been hanged with a towel. Unquote. On the same day, Polish architect Ludwig Pisarek related that on 29 June he had gone to the NKVD prison to look for his brother, arrested in December 1940. Quote, the prison had already been abandoned by the Russians, although the city of Lvov had not yet been evacuated by the Russians. I entered the prison and looked into the individual cells. These were scenes of horror. The cells were completely full with corpses. In a large room of 10 by 5 meters, I saw bodies piled up to a height of about a meter and a half, unquote. Also on 7 July 1941, Irene Lush, a Ukrainian housewife, testified that she had gone to the same prison on 28 or 29 June to look for her mother, quote, who had been arrested some 3 months before because of her religious convictions. As wife of a pastor of a Greek Orthodox church, she had asked a member of her parish why he did not go to church. When I entered the prison, I immediately saw dead people in the first cell. The bodies were mutilated. I saw a woman with a breast cut off. Another woman had had her abdomen slit open. She had been pregnant. Before that, I had already been to the Semarstinov prison to search for my mother. There I could only see from the outside into a room that was filled up with corpses all the way to the ceiling, unquote. After numerous other Poles and Ukrainians were interrogated by the German judges, Mueller drafted a report on 16 July 1941, which he sent together with the originals of all depositions to the War Crimes Bureau. The next section is headed Knowledge of Lvov Murders in the Outside World. The Bureau collected and evaluated information from various sources and used part of its documentation on Lvov to prepare its first study of the war in Russia, titled War Crimes of the Soviet Armed Forces, dated November 1941. Numerous depositions were also used in the White Book of the German Foreign Office, titled Bolshevist War Crimes and Crimes Against Humanity, of which the British Foreign Office obtained a copy through its legation in Switzerland. One important non-German organization that participated in the investigations was the Ukrainian Red Cross. On 7 July 1941, it addressed an appeal to the German city commander, quote, over 4,000 corpses have been found in Lvov's prisons. It is hardly possible to describe the condition in which the bodies were found. Full of anguish and consternation because of the fate of all Ukrainians who remain in prisons and concentration camps throughout the Soviet Union, the Ukrainian Red Cross requests that the entire civilized world be informed by radio of these atrocities. In particular, we urge the Swiss, Swedish, and Dutch Red Cross societies to take measures to protect the lives of those who are endangered so that they may still be saved, unquote. Information also reached the outside world through Polish confidential agents and others, such as the Polish professor Olgierd Gorka, who reported from Sweden that the Russians had killed some 160 Poles at the Brigidki prison before evacuating the town. All these and other reports led the British Foreign Office to address a note to Soviet Foreign Minister Vyacheslav Molotov, who predictably rejected the accusations on 12 July 1941. But when Sir Frank Roberts, a British Foreign Service officer involved in Polish-Russian relations during the war, mentioned the Gorka report to the foreign minister of the Polish government in exile, Edward Rasinski, he replied that there was, quote, little doubt that the Polish and Ukrainian political prisoners in Lvov had in fact been liquidated as alleged, unquote. It was not until the Nuremberg trials, however, that Lvov was discussed at length in the international community, and then attention focused not on the NKVD killings described above, but rather on the extensive liquidations carried out by the SD and SS. The Nuremberg indictment charged that, quote, in the Lvov region and in the city of Lvov, the Germans exterminated about 700,000 Soviet people, including 70 persons in the field of the arts, science, and technology, unquote. On 15 February 1946, Soviet prosecutor L.N. Smirnov referred to a report of the Extraordinary State Commission on Crimes Committed by the Germans in the territory of the Lvov region. According to that report, even before the German seizure of Lvov, the Gestapo detachments were preparing lists of the most prominent representatives of the intelligentsia who were to be annihilated. He charged that mass arrests and executions began immediately after the seizure of Lvov. Well, of course, that's the Soviet propaganda that held sway for quite a while that I mentioned earlier, and that was allowed to take place at the Nuremberg and other war crimes trials, in spite of the fact that the Americans and the British knew it wasn't true. But they, the cowardly hypocrites that they are, a hypocrite is far too weak a word to use for the Americans and the British, who allied with the Soviet Union and continued to cover up for them all the way through until around the 1950s or so. And even then they didn't say anything. Even today they don't say anything. Because they're the lowest of the low. They absolutely, you have to see them as the lowest of the low. They pretend that they are the heroes and the great ones and the saviors of human rights and so on. And they collaborate with the worst killer of all time, the Soviet Union of Russia, during that period of time under Stalin. And we see that even in this book, in 1989, this pretense had to continue to be played out. Continuing, German SD documents introduced by the prosecution at the principal trial and later at the American trial of SS General Otto Ohlendorf, Nuremberg Trial Number 9, shows that the civilian population of the city as well as the SD participated in the abuses. For instance, an SD report dated 31st July 1941 asserts that, quote, the population rounded up some 1,000 Jews. The population, remember, the population rounded up some 1,000 Jews and drove them to the prison that had been occupied by the Wehrmacht, unquote. The same report continues, quote, the Lvov prisons were full with the corpses of murdered Ukrainians, between 3 and 4,000. Reliable information also indicates that some 20,000 Ukrainians, of whom at least 80% belonged to the intelligentsia, were deported to inner Russia. Similar conditions were observed in the neighboring towns, that is, Dobromil, Sambor, and vicinity. As reprisal for these atrocities, 7,000 Jews were picked up and shot. As a footnote to this, it says that, footnote number 25 in this chapter, in the BA film, I assume BA is Bundesarchive, in their film archive, the 16mm black and white film titled Soviet Massacres and a newsreel both show the corpses of Ukrainians in the Lvov prisons and the pogrom-like disorders and beatings of Jews by Ukrainian civilians. I have located some of these photos and film, maybe not what is referred to here, though, and I will link to them in the program post. Continuing, Erwin Schultz, chief of a division of SS Einsatzgruppe C, which arrived in Lvov early in July 1941, reported in an affidavit for the Ohlendorf trial, dated 26 May 1947, quote, I saw the thousands of murdered persons and horrendous mutilations in Lvov. I smelled the awful stench of decomposing corpses that prevailed in the city and saw many weeping women, men, and children who were looking for their relatives, unquote. Otto Rasch, chief of the SS Einsatzgruppe C, claimed that it was Jewish officials and civilians who had been responsible for the killing of the political prisoners, and thus he gave his Sonderkommandos an order from Hitler that reprisals were to be taken against guilty persons and against major suspects. These statements were both from the Nuremberg trials. In affidavits given for the Nuremberg defense, however, senior German officers who had been in Lvov briefly after its capture confirmed the SD and SS reports of the bodies found in the prisons and the reaction of local civilians. but also testified that the German military authorities had issued orders to prevent violence against the Jewish population. General Max Winkler said, quote, "I remember hearing the figure of some 4,000 corpses. As a reaction to these murders, the Ukrainian population immediately started to drag the Jews out of their homes and to abuse them in the streets. The provisional commander of Lvov, Colonel Fingergerst of the 49th Army Corps, succeeded in stopping these excesses by giving orders to German troops and sending special patrols through the streets," unquote. General Egbert Picker said, quote, "In the courtyard of the state prison, I saw many rows of corpses laid next to each other, many of them with the most grotesque mutilations. I also saw in a small courtyard some 15 corpses, apparently Jews, who had been killed as reprisal by the local population shortly after the Russians evacuated the town. Jews were being taken to the prison by local civilians wearing armbands, and in one case they were being beaten with a bat. General Kubler told me that he had ordered such acts of violence by the civilian population against Jewish persons to be immediately stopped," unquote. General Hans Kreppel said, quote, "In the first hours of the occupation of Lvov, I personally saw hundreds of bodies of murdered Ukrainians. I also remember an order of the 49th Army Corps forbidding the Ukrainian population to persecute the Jews," unquote. Similar affidavits were introduced in evidence by the defense in the trial against Field Marshal von Manstein, 1949, in Hamburg. So we know from this that the Ukrainian people knew that it was the Jews among them who was working for the Soviets and persecuting them and murdering them and putting them in prison and so on, that it was the Jews who were helping the Red Army, that they had applauded when the Red Army came in. So they were going to take their revenge or reprisal against these Jews, and that was what was going on. In some cases, supposedly, it said that the SS and SD stood by and allowed it to happen. But that's all they did. They didn't do it themselves, and they weren't murdering any Ukrainians while they were there. So this statement earlier in the Nuremberg presented by the Soviets that 700,000 Soviet people were murdered by the Germans, or exterminated by the Germans, is just one big lie. The next section is headed Post-War Investigations. In 1954, the U.S. House of Representatives established a select committee on communist aggression under the chairmanship of Congressman Charles Kirsten of Wisconsin. You see how this is? In 1944, they were 100% for the communists. Now, in 1954, they're investigating what took place under these communists. Aren't they great? Continuing, at hearings in Munich, New York, and Chicago, hundreds of witnesses testified on a variety of topics, including the systematic killing of political prisoners by the NKVD. The committee's report reads in part, quote, "In every city in western Ukraine in the first days of the war, the NKVD and its agents shot all of the political prisoners, except a mere handful who were miraculously saved. One of those, Valentina Nahirnyak, who had been connected with the theater in Rivne, has given a graphic account of her escape. She had been in a cell with seven other women. A band of the murderers came into the cell and shot with their automatics at the group until they fell. All but three were dead. A little later, a man entered the cell and bayoneted all three of these. But Miss Nahirnyak's wounds were still not mortal, although she had received six bullet wounds and two bayonet cuts. The same process continued as the German armies advanced into the eastern Ukraine. Here the communists had more time than in the extreme west, but even in Vinnytsia, some 700 bodies were found near the railroad station. In Kharkiv, one of the main prisons was closed and set on fire, while the NKVD remained on guard to prevent any assistance until the interior was destroyed and the inmates were all dead. Unquote. Similar statements were given by other Ukrainian witnesses who testified before the House committee, including Bohdan Kosniewski, whose deposition had already been taken by the Germans in July 1941. The Lvov case gained renewed attention in the fall of 1959 when the Soviet press mounted a major disinformation campaign against a minister in the West German Adenauer cabinet, Theodor Oberländer, accusing him of participating in the SS murders there. On 5th September 1959, the Radianska Ukraina, a newspaper, wrote, quote, 18 years ago, the fascists committed a horrendous crime in Lvov in the night of 29-30 June 1941. The Hitlerites arrested on the basis of prepared lists hundreds of communists, communist youth, and non-party members and murdered them in brutal fashion in the courtyard of the Samarsinov prison, unquote. These accusations were picked up by the Western press and eventually led to Oberländer's resignation. The investigation by the district attorney's office in Bonn, however, completely cleared him. At about the same time, an international commission was set up at The Hague in the Netherlands to carry out independent investigations. The members were four former anti-Hitler activists, Norwegian lawyer Hans Kaperlin, former Danish foreign minister and president of the Danish parliament, Ole Bjorn Kraft, Dutch socialist Carol van Staal, Belgian law professor Floor Peters, and Swiss jurist and member of parliament, Kurt Sosch. Following its interrogation of a number of Ukrainian witnesses between November 1959 and March 1960, the commission concluded, quote, after 4 months of inquiries and the evaluation of 232 statements by witnesses from all circles involved, it can be established that the accusations against the battalion Nachtigall and against the then lieutenant and currently federal minister Oberländer have no foundation in fact. Unquote. The extensive journalistic and historical activity of Ukrainians in exile further confirmed the results of the investigations carried out by the War Crimes Bureau in 1941. Roman Ilnitsky's study condemns both the murders perpetrated in the Ukraine by the SS and the NKVD murders in Lvov. A collection of documents dealing with Russian colonialism in the Ukraine devotes an entire chapter to the liquidation of Ukrainian political prisoners by the NKVD, not only in Lvov, but also in Vinnytsia, Solotsjiv, and a dozen other localities. It reproduces numerous reports of Ukrainian eyewitnesses living today in the United States, Canada, and the Federal Republic of Germany. Ukrainian journalist and author Boris Lewitsky wrote in 1960, quote, the responsibility of the Soviet authorities for the murders perpetrated in the Lvov prisons and also for the murders in other prisons in Galicia and in the Ukraine is clear and overwhelming. There is justification to suppose that in Soviet circles there were agitators who wanted to put the blame for these atrocities on the German army of occupation and on the Gestapo. It is known that the shooting of prison hostages took place even in Kiev. The Polish embassy in Moscow later received many reports of specific instances in which senior Polish civil servants had been killed in the Kiev prisons. As for the killings in the Lvov detention centers, the entire population of the town and its vicinity knew what had happened during those tragic days in June. Unquote. The next section is headed Further Investigations, and this is the last section. Periodically, reports appear in the press that new mass graves have been discovered in the Soviet Union. Again and again, reference to the Lvov murders resurfaces, and there is a tendency, even in the Western press, to give some credence to Soviet propaganda and to assume that the Germans may indeed have killed the Ukrainian political prisoners in the Brigidki, Semarstanov, and OGPU prison. Surely the Germans would have been capable of committing such crimes, says our author. But in this case, the evidence is overwhelmingly that they did not. Because of the persistent political misuse of the Lvov murders, it was necessary to find as many surviving eyewitnesses as possible. Only one of the German judges, Wilhelm Müller, and four Ukrainian witnesses could be located and questioned by him, he means. On 20th August 1976, Judge Müller stated, quote, "The copies of the depositions of witnesses about the events in Lvov, which are before me, describe the facts as I still remember them. The investigations were carried out without any influence or pressure from any side or from any other agency." Unquote. In December 1976, and again in December 1977, the author, meaning Desaias, visited the Ukrainian witness Bohdan Kozhinitsky at his home in Philadelphia. He confirmed and expanded on his version of the events as described in the 1941 deposition and at the 1954 congressional hearings. Leo Fedoruk, another Ukrainian witness who had testified before Judge Müller, also granted an interview in Philadelphia in December 1977, as did Maria Strutnitska, who had not been questioned by the Germans in 1941, but had testified before the International Commission at The Hague in 1960. Mrs. Strutnitska, the widow of a Lvov victim, journalist Mikhailaus Strutnitsky, stated, quote, "When the Wehrmacht entered Lvov, all prisons were already full of murdered prisoners. There had been two huge mass graves that had been superficially covered with earth. Here and there an elbow or a foot was visible. When the Bolshevists left, they set fire to the Brigidki prison, and the Germans had to organize a special workforce which spent an entire week removing charred bodies." Unquote. So that's a good point there that I was going to make, that the Soviets, the miserable Soviets, created all this mess, murdered all these people, left all these bodies piled up in all these cellars and rooms in these prisons, and then the Germans came and had to clean it all up. They had to deal with it. They had to pull the bodies out. They had a lot of work to do. All this work was left for the Germans. And then, of course, those nasty Soviets try to blame the Germans for it. And they're still doing that. And they're still just as nasty as they ever were. Still the same type of lying people that they always have been. Continuing. Still another witness who had appeared before the International Commission was Mrs. A.K., who on 1st April 1977 remembered her experience as follows. Quote, "In the fall of 1940, I was arrested by the NKVD in Lvov because of my membership in the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists. I was detained in the Semarstanov prison until the beginning of June 1941, from fall till the following June. I was then transferred to the Brigidki prison because I was sick, and I was supposed to be hospitalized for treatment of jaundice and kidney problems. But instead, I was thrown into the cellar of the prison. When the German-Soviet war broke out on 22nd June 1941, I was detained in a cell in the cellar. The cell was bursting with other women detainees. At short intervals, the guards called out individual prisoners or small groups who then had to go out in the hallway with all their possessions. They kept calling people from Tuesday until Friday. In the early hours of Saturday, the voices of other prisoners from the higher floors became audible. Right then we realized that there were no more guards in the prison, and so the detainees broke the door open and rushed into the halls. I then went toward the Semarstanov prison, and on my way I met another woman with whom I had been interned. She told me that according to another Semarstanov detainee, my brother had been murdered there. I went to look for his body. Upon arrival I saw that a great many people were already standing outside the gate. The bodies were laid out in four rows. I counted 40 corpses, among them 13 women. I was able to identify three women with whom I had shared a cell. I saw that the corpses had many broken bones. Among the male corpses, I could not find my brother, perhaps because I did not know what clothing he had been wearing in prison. I asked whether there were more bodies at the prison and received a positive answer. I was told, however, that the rest of the corpses were unrecognizable as a result of advanced decomposition. Unquote. Certainly, all these statements should be carefully compared with others so as to discover possible errors or exaggerations. This principle applies to the testimony of all witnesses who have been victims of crime. But if a historian wants to study the reality of murders and persecutions, it is imperative to identify and interrogate the victims. Surely the victims have a better recollection of events than the perpetrators, who prefer to keep their silence, or better, to forget. The mass murders of political prisoners by the NKVD in Lvov are still frequently confused with the anti-Jewish pogroms of the local population and with the liquidations perpetrated by the SD. Yeah, well, we still don't have any clear evidence of liquidations perpetrated by the SD. I'm not saying there wouldn't be any. But clear separation lines must be drawn between the three murder phases. With regard to the first phase, the War Crimes Bureau's investigations are thoroughly confirmed by the affidavits presented by the defense at the Nuremberg trials and by the subsequent inquiries of the United States Congress and the International Commission at The Hague. The other two phases, on which the available Bureau records provide no information whatever, have been well documented in the records of a number of war crimes trials. And what does Desaias give as evidence of a number of war crime trials? 1. Trial number 9 at Nuremberg, U.S. versus Otto Ohlendorf. And that's the one exchange that they have created all this idea that there was murder by the SD. I have looked into the Ohlendorf testimony myself, but it was quite a while ago. And as I recall, it wasn't what they have made it out to be. And I don't know whether I'd have the time to go back and look at that and go into that. But I would recommend that any of you who are interested, go and look at the testimony of Otto Ohlendorf, where you find the transcripts of the Nuremberg trials in full. And they can be found on the internet. So this is the end of chapter 20, titled Lvov. Next week, ladies and gentlemen, I will be covering Chapter 21, Katyn. It's not as long as this one on Lvov, so I will also do the short chapter on Vinnytsia the next time. And after that, we have Shipwrecked Survivors. And after that, a chapter on hospital ships. And that will be it. So I want to thank you for listening to the Wehrmacht War Crimes Bureau series, presented by me, Carolyn Yeager. Until next time.